From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. As we move through college football's bowl season and into the heart of college basketball season, the head of a higher education watchdog group reminds us about serious problems linked to big-time college sports. North Carolina's junior U.S. senator is pushing a measure to help victims of sanctuary cities. You'll learn details. Another member of the state's congressional delegation wants government to do a better job helping prisoners re-enter the workforce after their sentences. And we'll highlight recent letters from both the governor and the lieutenant governor to public school teachers. They focus on the state's ongoing budget fight. Those topics are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us, and she has the Carolina Journal headline.
North Carolina's U.S. Senate race promises to be one to watch on election night next November. Republican incumbent Tom Tillis wants another term in the Senate, and Democrats would love to turn that seat blue. But for now, voter attention is on the matchups for the March primary races, and a big development recently on the Republican side of this race. Carolina Journal is covering this race very closely. Rick Henderson is editor-in-chief, and he joins us now. Rick, welcome back.
Thanks, Donna.
So one primary challenger to Tom Tillis has dropped out already.
Right. Garland Tucker, Raleigh businessman, investment advisor, self-funded his campaign largely, put something like $1 million of his own money into this. And Garland Tucker is a historian and, as I say, an investment counselor, and decided to drop out. Basically, the excuse he gave, or the reason he gave, was that he said that at the time, the impeachment proceedings in Washington were sort of sucking all the oxygen out of the political race right now, and that he didn't feel it was worthwhile for him to move forward with his campaign.
I thought it was interesting as well that some of Garland Tucker's messaging had to do with whether or not Senator Tom Tillis was supporting President Trump.
Right.
And it appears now that Senator Tillis has been endorsed by the president,
right,
at a rally, but also that the senator is talking about voting no on impeachment.
Right. So you've got the situation with Garland Tucker was that he announced that there needed to be a real conservative in the race at the time. He said Tom Tillis was not a real conservative. Tucker also had criticized candidate Trump pretty significantly before the 2016 election, and then suddenly flipped and became the president's biggest supporter. Of course, Tom Tillis himself has had his own history, having an op-ed that was published in the Washington Post saying that the president did not have the authority to, I believe, to do some things with border funding and the like, and then 2 weeks later changing his mind and voting for the bill that allowed that to happen. So there's been a lot of jockeying going around about who's the real supporter of the president going into this race. And Senator Tillis has come forward and said that he's the guy. And the Republicans, I think, have pretty much coalesced around him now.
And we will see, once the dust settles and all the filing is over, if there are any others who,
right,
jump into the Republican primary race for U.S. Senate. At this point, Rick, we know that there are at least five Democrats who would love to be their party's nominee to try to challenge Tillis. Interesting that the polling tends to show that Tom Tillis could be vulnerable, and that's what the Democrats, the National Democrats, are seizing on. So we have five people who, at the point that you and I are talking, have officially filed. We've got Trevor Fuller, Steve Swenson, Atul Goel, Erica Smith, and Cal Cunningham. And it's those last two people who are getting a lot of publicity.
Right. Cal Cunningham's a former state senator. He has run for other offices before. He has received the support of the National Democratic Campaign Committee, the Senatorial Campaign Committee. And so he has also gotten, raised lots of money, done fundraisers and the like. We spoke about him in a recent episode of Carolina Journal Radio, in which he was the person who decided to sit in the windowless basement and make phone calls and raise money.
Explain that phrase, where that came from the National Democrats.
There was Senator Jeff Jackson, who's a state senator from Mecklenburg County, said he had been courted by the Democratic leadership in Washington. But what Senator Jackson said he wanted to do was he wanted to go around the state and meet voters and explain the platform and why he would be a better senator than Tom Tillis and the like. And he said he was told by the Democrats, no, we want you to sit in a windowless basement and spend all your time making phone calls and chasing down money from donors.
Oh, my goodness.
And so Senator Jackson said, well, I'm not interested in doing that. But apparently Cal Cunningham was a guy who was interested in doing that. And so
he's been endorsed.
He's been endorsed, indeed. Erica Smith has not gotten that endorsement, and she has not taken well to that at all. First of all, she has won more than one race for the state Senate. She is from Northampton County and has been in the Senate for several terms. The interesting thing about this race is that former state Supreme Court Justice Bob Orr said on a recent episode of NC Spin that in some ways Cal Cunningham is the ideal candidate that national Democrats would like to see run in North Carolina for the Senate. He's a veteran. He has won office at the state level before. He has not won a statewide race, but he has been elected. He can raise money. He's very photogenic and the like. But Erica Smith may be the candidate that, say, that the national Democratic activist groups may be more likely to see. African-American woman, again, state elected official still currently, and someone who is likely to be a very ferocious campaigner as well. And Cal Cunningham remains to be seen how dynamic he would be on the campaign trail. Of course, Tom Tillis is not exactly a fire brimstone campaigner himself. There would certainly be a contrast in lots of ways if Erica Smith won the primary, but she's got an uphill battle there.
This sounds like a really interesting primary race to follow on the Democratic side here.
Yeah, it is, because it's going to be fascinating to see if Senator Smith can actually generate enough support for her campaign to be a viable candidate, to actually run ads, to travel around the state, to go to events and things like that. And if Cal Cunningham is actually going to show up at these events, if he's going to try to act as if he doesn't have any competition, that he's basically running against Tom Tillis now. This happens a lot in political campaigns where someone who is presumed to be a front runner just simply ignores all the other candidates and runs against the likely general election opponent. And so if that's the way the campaign shapes up, it's going to be really interesting to watch.
Now, we said he's received the endorsement from the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee.
Yep. Right.
Wondering if any national Democrats will come in on his behalf in the primary, if they think that perhaps Senator Erica Smith does have all of that grassroots support that you're talking about.
We will see, I'm sure, presidential contenders come into the state. And when that happens, it will be interesting to see who appears with them.
Exactly. And speaking of the presidential race, also some fascinating dynamics going on with the filing for the presidential primary here in North Carolina. Now, on the Republican side, President Trump is on the ballot. No one else. And apparently there's a reason for that.
The state party would not allow anyone else on the ballot, essentially. So they've just said President Trump's going to be the nominee. So let's not worry our little heads about having any other people to vote for.
Well, curious. But what's really interesting is that our listeners may not realize that it looks like there are five different parties where candidates have filed representing five different parties in these primaries. Tell us about that.
We've got the Constitution Party, which has two candidates. We've got the Green Party, Green Party has one candidate. We've got the Libertarian Party, which has 16 candidates. And then there are 15 Democrats on the ballot. More than likely, it's hard to say about the Libertarians, but more than likely, of these 15 Democrats, by the time people actually start by primary day, now people will start voting by absentee ballot fairly soon. But by primary day, it would be very odd if there were more than, say, five or six who were viable candidates at that point. But right now we got 15.
Wow. And the whole issue of 16 libertarians, and they are from across the country.
Right.
Libertarians are notorious for saying, look, I am not associated with the Republican Party, the Democratic Party, or anybody else. I'm a free thinker. Is that what we're likely to hear from some of those candidates?
From the ones we hear from at all, there are going to be a couple of names. One name that people might know is John McAfee of the McAfee Systems, the computer software person who's a bit of a gonzo candidate who will probably be very active. Jacob Hornberger, for people in libertarian circles, he's been an activist for a long, long time.
We've been talking with Rick Henderson. He's editor-in-chief of Carolina Journal. Carolina Journal covering all of these races very closely. You can find that at carolinajournal.com. Rick, thank you.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment. Tired of fake news? Tired of reporters with political axes to grind? Well, you need to be reading Carolina Journal. Honest, uncompromising, old-school journalism you expect and you need. Even better, the monthly Carolina Journal is free to subscribers. Sign up at carolinajournal.com. You'll receive Carolina Journal newspaper in your mailbox each month. Investigations into government spending, revelations about boondoggles, who the powerful leaders are, and what they're doing in your name and with your money. We shine the light on it all with the stories and angles other outlets barely cover. But there's a bonus. Our print newspaper is published monthly, but our daily news site gives you the latest news each and every day. Log on to carolinajournal.com once, twice, even three times a day. You won't be disappointed. It's fresh news. And if you'd like a heads up on the daily news, sign up for our daily email. Do that at carolinajournal.com. Carolina Journal, rigorous, unrelenting, old school journalism. We hold government accountable for you.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Division I college football and basketball are no longer amateur sports. That's the assessment from our next guest. Jenna Robinson is president of the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal. She recently spoke to the John Locke Foundation's Shaftesbury Society. Her topic focused on the increased professionalization of big-time college sports and its negative consequences. Welcome back to the program, Jenna.
It's great to be here, Mitch.
So it really is pretty clear these days, anyone who watches these sporting events, this is not just a bunch of college kids getting together and playing a game. It is almost exactly like a pro sport.
It really is. They are talented. They are tough. They work harder than probably any of the other college sports. And it tells when you watch. And obviously the money has followed and just made the whole thing even worse.
It makes it fun for us who watch the sports and like to see high quality athletic competition. But the content of your discussion with the Shaftesbury Society and the reason that you're focusing on this is because of negative consequences. Talk to us about that.
Right. I think the biggest problem is that a Division I college athlete in a really competitive sport is essentially asked to do two jobs, two full-time jobs, to be a student and to be an athlete. And it is compounded by the fact that colleges recruit students to be athletes who would not have gotten into that school otherwise. And so their job of being a student is harder than it ought to be because they're starting out behind all of their peers.
You mentioned the fact that this has negative consequences for and perverse incentives for all the people involved. How does this play out?
Absolutely. Well, I mean, the first people for whom it has negative consequences are obviously the athletes themselves. They often can't do the work. They don't have time to do the work. They are supposedly given resources to help them do the work, but often it gets them accused of cheating. And rightly so, because it is cheating. Of course, the cheating doesn't affect just those athletes. It affects faculty members whose classes they are in. It affects the other students who are in those classes. It affects the university itself. There's a lot of pressure to dumb down some courses, to attract athletes to them. We saw what happened at UNC. There was immense pressure, and they ended up creating fake courses. And there is the easy A's that are often given out to athletes, and there are incentives for cheating. Just outright cheating. Incentives for the school or the athletics program or a counselor or whoever just to do whatever it takes to get that athlete and keep that athlete eligible.
We are chatting with Jenna Robinson, who is president of the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal. This also plays out in the incentives that are there for coaches. The coaches are not just saying, okay, kid off the campus, come on and play for my team.
Right.
I mean, they're recruiting high quality athletes,
right,
and not really necessarily high quality students.
Absolutely. They are rewarded for winning. They're not rewarded for putting together a team of, all American straight shooters. So they go out and they find the most talented kids they can, regardless of whether those students are ready and willing to do college level work. And when the team wins, the coaches are well compensated. They get to stay on. I mean, I see it all the time. They talk about, well, this coach is going to be fired if he doesn't, you know, win X number of games this season. And if that's your incentive structure as a coach, why would you pay attention to grades at all, except just to make sure that athletes are doing the bare minimum to stay eligible?
So we've talked about the effects on coaches. We've talked about the effects on athletes. You're also focusing on attention on how this impacts other students. If other students who aren't anywhere near being athletes are on a big time college campus, they could also feel some impacts. How so?
Well, I think the first way is that someone is not getting in to UNC or to Duke to make room for that athlete, someone who is academically much better prepared to be there. And we don't know who those students are. We don't know who the person was who just didn't make the cut because they needed to let in the star athlete. But also, if you are there on campus and you sit in classes with athletes, you wonder, what is the quality of this class? Am I being treated the same way that athletes are being treated? You notice that athletes will miss classes and still manage to pass. You'll notice that athletes are turning in less work than you are. And it really does degrade those classes because the standards are not being upheld for everyone.
We've talked about some problems. Now let's turn the tide a little bit and say, okay, we know this is a problem. What sorts of things can we do to help address this?
Well, I think the first thing that we should do is revert back to the NBA's old rules. We can get rid of these one-and-dones. The NBA should once again take students right out of high school, just like LeBron James. Making students go to college for a year and pretend to be interested in higher education while they're really just waiting for the draft, it means that there are some really fun, high-quality basketball games you can watch, but it's really doing everybody a disservice. Those students need to go directly to the NBA and stop being students and just be basketball players, because that's clearly what they're best at. We also need to see changes at the universities. Universities need to stop giving athletes waivers. Athletes who haven't taken the requisite number of math courses or English courses or haven't gotten the grades or the SAT scores, universities need to stop doing that so that when the athletes get to school, at least they're not starting out behind all their peers. It'll still be hard for them to be an athlete and a student, but at least they won't start out from behind. And the other thing that is really exciting is that there's a new historical basketball league starting up, and I am encouraged by this. It's private. It's a summer league. The athletes will be paid somewhere between $50,000 and $150,000 per season, and it's kind of like a minor league for the NBA. It's going to be starting in 2020. The athletes will be able to benefit from their name, their image, their likeness, and if they want to, because it's a summer league, they can still go to college at the same time. And so that's a private market alternative that I really like.
Now, one of the other things we've heard as a possibility, and I want to get your thoughts on this, if the university is going to be bringing in students who aren't up to snuff academically and sticking with that system, they need to have much more in terms of resources for those students so they could actually get a real academic grounding as they're getting the athletics. Do you think that's something to pursue as well?
I think that there are ways to do it that will solve the problem, and then there are ways to do it that'll just make cheating more likely. I think one thing I do like is giving a lifelong scholarship so that if the student does leave, he or she can come back after their NBA career or NFL career is done and get their college education at the back end. And I think that erases some of the problems that you see. And I like that a lot better than just saying, well, we're going to give more academic coaching or counseling, because we've seen that too many times that turns into having somebody to do your homework for you.
Well, it's a very interesting topic, and anyone who's ever watched a college football or basketball game ought to be interested in this and how it plays out. One person who certainly is and who will be working on these types of changes and improvements is Jenna Robinson. She is president of the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal. Thanks so much for joining us, Jenna.
Thanks, Mitch.
We'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups across North Carolina all in one place. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. It's one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, opinion pieces and reports on higher education from the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Try it today.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation, and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Who knew you could shop and invest in freedom at the same time? It is true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate the John Locke Foundation to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop. Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. Here's how. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile is the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible Amazon Smile purchases to the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate us as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today. Buy something nice and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. North Carolina's experience with sanctuary cities recently got some attention on Capitol Hill. That was courtesy of the state's Republican Senator Tom Tillis.
Sanctuary cities sounds like a great concept, as the United States is a sanctuary for so many people that seek it to immigrate to. But the sanctuary cities policy is actually a policy that is breaking down the relationship between federal authorities and local authorities that I think is dangerous and could potentially cause serious consequences in communities. And not only potentially, I'll use a few examples. In North Carolina, over the past year, we've had over 500 people released who were arrested by local authorities, many of them for serious crimes, charged with murder, rape, indecent liberties with a child, heroin trafficking, a very, very long list. And cities just 25 minutes from where I live, down in Charlotte, Mecklenburg County. They're arresting people not because they're simply illegally present. In fact, you can find virtually no instance where a local authority would arrest somebody just because they know that they're illegally present. The people that are in these jails have been charged with a crime, and in many cases, a serious crime. In Mecklenburg County, 2 weeks ago, the Mecklenburg County Sheriff had made the decision
to release four people, one charged with murder, two charged with indecent liberties with a minor, one charged with heroin trafficking. They were illegally present, but they weren't in jail because they had simply crossed the border or had a visa expire. They were in jail because they committed a serious crime. Now, when Immigrations and Customs Enforcement hears about these folks who have been detained, they issue what they call a detainer order. That's a request to hold that person in jail for at least 48 hours so that ICE can go to the prison or go to the jail, interview them, and determine whether or not they want to transfer them into ICE custody and potentially deport them. This is a very dangerous policy that's actually ultimately resulted in other people being harmed. So think about that person charged with rape or that person charged with murder or that person charged with heroin trafficking released. They go back into the community and they cause harm to someone else. What I've decided we need to do is at least provide a private right of civil action to a victim of that unwise decision. It's called the Justice for Victims of Sanctuary Cities Act.
Tillis's proposed law would give people across the country the right to sue governments that impose sanctuary city policies if those policies end up causing real physical harm. Tillis's idea would have to clear both the U.S. Senate and the House to become law. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
We're doubling down on freedom. At Carolina Journal Radio, we're proud to bring you stories that impact your life and your wallet. And now, get twice as much freedom when you also listen to our podcast, Headlock, available on iTunes and at johnlock.org/podcast. Now, Headlock is a little bit different. It's a no-holds-barred discussion that challenges soft-headed ideas from the left and the right. But like Carolina Journal Radio, Headlock is smart and timely. But with Headlock, you'll hear more about the culture wars, and you'll get some more humor as well. We guarantee great information and a good time. Double down with us. Listen to Carolina Journal Radio each week, and listen to Headlock, too. Remember, you can listen to Headlock at johnlock.org/podcast, or subscribe or download each week at iTunes. Carolina Journal Radio and Headlock, just what you need to stay informed and stay entertained. Both brought to you in the name of freedom by the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Most people who go to prison eventually get out. What steps can government take? What steps should it take to ensure those people stay out of prison once they re-enter society? That's a question North Carolina Congressman Mark Walker recently addressed in Greensboro. Walker took part in a forum to promote his proposal, the Prison to Prosperity Act.
I grew up as a preacher's kid, Baptist preacher's kid in the South, and my dad was assigned or actually voted in to be the chaplain of a prison there about 20 miles away. And as a youngster, I began to travel with him sometimes on those Saturday mornings, and I remember beginning to sit on those bunk beds and hearing some of the stories and begin to think, man, that was a very smart person. I thought about the mistake, and they would say, you know, stay out of this, don't do that. But I'm thinking that the level of talent and the level of wonderful people that sometimes were locked up for things that as we've looked back, we wonder, did we get it all right? And just a couple numbers here. We have about 2.2 to 2.3 million people right now that are incarcerated in the United States. So if you look at that, that's about Russia and China combined. So think about that statistic. Number two, we have another 3.7 million people on probation, 728,000 local jails. And where it really pulls on your heartstrings is the next generation, because you have 2.7 million children, one out of 28 have an incarcerated parent. But here's the number that popped at me when I started looking at this. One out of 110 Caucasian parents, but one out of 15 African-American or black people have a child incarcerated. So I said, well, what's the reasoning behind that? And I reflected on my years as a pastor, some of the inner city ministries that we worked in, where people just said, what can we bring? They said, bring hope. just bring hope. God began to work on my heart. Some people say, are you over spiritualizing this? Well, I'm going to just tell you where it came from, I believe, to begin to say, what is it that we can do to bridge that gap from incarceration, to bring about the training, the apprenticeships?
So Walker has proposed a Prison to Prosperity Act.
Let's start with this statistic here. 60% of the 650,000 inmates released every year are incarcerated within 365 days. Say that again. 60% of the 650,000 employees or inmates incarcerated are unemployed within 1 year. See, a job is where many times you begin to find that self-worth. You begin to realize, hey, you matter, I'm contributing something. So what we did, the Prison of Prosperity Act, without getting into the weeds, it directs the Secretary of Labor, Secretary of Education, Secretary of Defense, and the Attorney General to establish or collaborate on their efforts to expand apprenticeships for these four categories. Number one, the most populated, is former inmates. Two is high school students. Three is armed service members and veterans. And four is individuals not currently attending an educational institution. The reason why that's important, if you're able to provide those apprenticeships, it builds a bridge to be able to find that, because we have seen as high as 90% of those that complete an apprenticeship are employed 1 year, 2 year, 5 years down the road, as opposed to just sending 650,000 formerly incarcerated people out into the workforce to say, hey, good luck, hope it works out for you. We've realized it's simply not working. And I think whether your motivation is humanitarian, whether it's from a civil rights perspective, or even it's from a fiscal responsibility, taxpayers are spending $70 billion each year to keep Americans incarcerated. So just looking at it from an economic standpoint, it doesn't make any sense. You can pick which. That's why it doesn't matter which side of the aisle that you're on, Democrat, Libertarian, Republican. There is great cause or reason to get behind this, and I believe that we're excited about getting this done and getting it signed into law.
That's Republican Congressman Mark Walker speaking recently in Greensboro. What's the response been among colleagues to the Prison to Prosperity Act?
I think we have a growing amount of support. Anytime you're introducing new legislation, you go through the committee, then it goes on to rules, then get the House floor for a vote, to the Senate, then the president signed the law. I know the president's personality can sometimes be very interesting, to say the least. But this is something he's been willing to do, First Step Act, criminal justice reform, and I'm grateful for that. But things like this aren't partisan. It's changing a culture. And it's getting that opportunity. And I will tell you this. And we're talking about this from Washington, D.C.'s perspective, but nothing in our history, in our country, ever started in Washington, D.C. Okay? And they might have closed it with legislation to codify it in the law, but there was a Baptist preacher from the South that had a problem with where the civil rights thing was headed, and it might have been a Republican. I'll throw that in there, but paved the way. There were college students about a half a mile from here. Mm-hmm. They didn't like the way this is. So if you look at it from the church or from the nonprofits, this is where it starts. Mm-hmm. This is the creativity, the ingenuity, the innovation. This is where the passion comes from. Part of our job in D.C. is to bring those thoughts together and get it across the finish line. Mm-hmm. But Washington, D.C. has never been the generator of a lot of these ideas. Mm-hmm. It's everyday people seeing a problem, seeing an issue with the justice system or something else, and say, we've had enough and we're going to fix it today.
Walker faced this question. How can people in Greensboro and North Carolina take action?
I think what you're doing right now is continuing to communicate, first of all, the need. I'll choose my words carefully. But there's a lot of ignorance as far as what's going on. And I was an adult before I began to take a second look at this, and realize, looking at the numbers, a lot of these numbers never cut through the media. They don't get out there. So a lot of times is communicating the situation. And most rational people will look at some of these numbers. And when you see over the last 40 years, the domestic incarceration rate has quadrupled, most rational people go, well, something's going on here. Something's not right.
Walker offered advice to would-be reformers.
Nothing ever happens without a relationship. Mm-hmm. If you're looking at people just because they're a number or through the political lens, I think you rarely have success. Mm-hmm. But if you look at them as somebody who God created with unique abilities and talents and skill sets, that's the message. Mm-hmm. And listen, we have people who have every reason to consider themselves victims. They've been through some heavy stuff. Mm-hmm. But how do you get to the place where you rise beyond that, and whether it's the federal government, a community, or anybody else that puts a ceiling on that, to be able to say, no, that God's done something. He's created me in a way to accomplish so much more. What we want this to be is just to be the conduit, and that's what I hope the people continue to talk about.
Walker emphasized the need to help people just as they leave prison and return to the outside world.
Urgency is very crucial. Mm-hmm. So when you're coming out from an incarcerated situation, mm-hmm. you don't have months to go figure this out. Right. The reason this apprenticeship, I believe, that works is because day one, you have to go out there and see that there's hope. Right. There's an opportunity. There's a path that's being created on the funding side from being able to provide that. I think if you're able to act early, I think your chances of success drastically increase.
What about the rules linked to hiring former prisoners? Walker discussed the Ban the Box movement.
For those who hire government employees, it's easier to get that place because we control that from a federal perspective. What's been a little bit more challenging to get enough support is for private industry. How much do you tell them they have to do on the people that they're looking to hire? But it is changing on the federal and the state employee side, because that's where government can have a role or specific say-so as far as what you can or can't do, questions you can ask, under the areas of discrimination, et cetera, et cetera. But what Congress and what the law, whether the Republicans or Democrats, haven't gone quite as far, and it's something they're still talking about, is do you take that same mentality, do you put that on the private entrepreneur, that when they're getting started or where they're hiring people, that you have to say, well, you can't ask these questions, you can't ask about that. And that's where the debate has come.
That's Congressman Mark Walker. He's touting potential benefits of his Prison to Prosperity Act. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
Real influence. You either have it or you don't. And at the John Locke Foundation, we have it. You'll find our guiding principles in many of the Freedom Forward reforms of the past decade here in North Carolina. So while others talk or complain or name call, we provide research, solutions, and hope. Our team analyzes the pressing issues of the day, jobs, health care, education, and more. We look for effective ways to give you more freedom, more options, more control over your life. Our goal is to transform North Carolina into a growing, thriving economic powerhouse, the envy of every other state. Our research has helped policymakers make decisions that ensure you keep more of what you earn, expand your choice of schools for your kids, widen your job opportunities, improve your access to doctors. The recipe for stability and a bright future. For truth, for freedom, for the future of North Carolina. We are the John Locke Foundation. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. Roughly 100,000 teachers are employed in North Carolina public schools, both traditional and charter schools. Now, the sheer size of this group and the influence that the North Carolina Association of Educators, the state affiliate of the largest teacher union in the country, means that teachers garner a lot of attention from elected officials. And right now, that attention is coming from both Governor Roy Cooper and Lieutenant Governor Dan Forrest. Dr. Terry Stoops is the Vice President for Research, the Director of Education Studies for the John Locke Foundation. He's been following this back and forth between these two elected officials and teachers and principals, and joins us now to talk about that. Terry, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
First of all, give us a sense, if you would, of how big a role that education plays in the state operating budget and kind of the recent disputes over the budget between the Democratic governor and the Republican-led General Assembly.
Well, education is one of the largest expenditures in the budget, and so it certainly garners a great deal of attention. And the one reason why teachers and staff specifically garner so much attention is that because over 90% of the money we spend on our public schools goes to personnel. A lot of people think that it goes to books and desks and those sorts of things, but the cost to support teachers and staff, their salary salary and benefits is an enormous cost to the state. So, of course, there's a lot of attention paid to them because they're the largest expense in our K-12 education budget is our teachers and staff. And so looking at teacher pay issues, as the governor and lieutenant governor have, of course, it affects a large number of teachers. And it affects as well the administrators and staff because those teachers are making decisions based on what their pay is and what their benefits look like.
Recent reporting out of several different publications has revealed that Governor Cooper sent an email to all the principals across the state. Tell us about that email.
Well, he sent a Christmas is coming up and I'm going to be the Grinch sort of email to all the teachers, basically explaining why he vetoed Republican budgets that had pay increases involved. And he came from his senior education advisor, Jeff Coltrane, and it was sent to all the principals in the state with the understanding that the principal would then forward it to their staff. And I can tell you that in many cases, at least according to online chatter, that's exactly what happened. Principals received the letter and they either forwarded the email to their staff or they printed out the letter and gave it to each of their teachers and teacher assistants and other staff in the school. So this set off a kind of head scratching moment where people were wondering, well, where did he get these email addresses? Why would he send them all to the principals? And you know, what's the nature of sending a letter this time of the year explaining why teachers aren't getting a raise?
Interesting. Tell us a little bit more, if you could, about the message in that communication from the governor. Was he saying, "Here's what I would like to do for you," or was he really focusing on policy? Because frankly, that gets into a very curious line between appropriate discussion of public policy issues and politics.
Yeah, and I think it crosses the line into politics, talking about wanting to get the General Assembly, the Republican General Assembly, to the table to negotiate teacher raises and justifying why he vetoed a budget that included teacher pay increases. And this is the same story that he's been telling ever since he issued the veto initially, is that the reason why he vetoed budgets that included pretty decent teacher pay increases was because he believed that that was a way to get the Republican General Assembly back to the table to negotiate these things. Well, you know, that really isn't how budgeting works in North Carolina. And the hope that he had and the claim that that was what was going to happen was really not based on any evidence, because the Republicans never mentioned once that they wanted to negotiate with the governor to discuss teacher pay raises.
What was really interesting a second time was that on the heels of the reporting about the email from the governor came news that the lieutenant governor, Dan Forrest, who is a Republican, Governor Cooper, of course, a Democrat, that the lieutenant governor also sent a communication, apparently, to people who are employed by schools. What do you know about that?
Well, this is a different circumstance because the lieutenant governor sits on the State Board of Education and has a formal role in education governance in North Carolina. So it wouldn't be unusual for someone in that kind of position to send a communication to teachers and administrators. And I think that's why the lieutenant governor thought that in response to Cooper's letter, it would be important for him to outline what has really happened over the last few years as far as teacher compensation. And that's what his letter does, is basically list all of the accomplishments of the Republican General Assembly. Those include getting the average teacher pay up to nearly $54,000 a year. That includes a 20% increase in teacher pay between 2014 and 2019. And it included all of the discussion about all of the budgets that were vetoed by the governor, including one budget that included a 9.9% average pay increase for teachers. And so Forrest's letter, Lieutenant Governor Forrest's letter, was just pointing out, here's what happened, and here is what I believe the real motivation for this, for Governor Cooper's letter. And he seemed to imply that it was to make the North Carolina Association of Educators happy and to do their bidding was what the lieutenant governor seemed to imply in his letter.
Pretty interesting. Terry, I know that because of what you do, this is your field of expertise, that you constantly monitor all sorts of Facebook pages and Twitter feeds and chat rooms, etc. What is happening online? What are people saying about these two pretty much opposing views of education policy and teacher pay ideas in North Carolina?
Well, judging from the online chatter, you would be under the impression that everyone supported Cooper and his decisions and his policies, because it's really the Cooper supporters, the supporters of the Democratic Party, that dominate the online discussion. And so you look at some of the Facebook pages and the Twitter feeds of individuals essentially speaking for teachers. But the reality is that this is just a handful of politically active teachers that are active on social media, sometimes during the school day, looking at ways to advance the cause of the Democratic Party and Governor Cooper. And that's really what is misleading about a lot of this online chatter. As you said, when you started this discussion, there are 100,000 teachers, and I would say that there's probably about 100 teachers online that are talking about all of these issues. And of course, most of them support the governor and the Democrats. I think that there's plenty of teachers out there that support Lieutenant Governor, that support the Republican General Assembly, like having lower taxes, like the fact that their pay has increased significantly over the last 5 years, but are just afraid to say so and stay off of social media and don't engage with those who are active on it.
And of course, for any teacher or any citizen in North Carolina who wants to know factual information about the education budget, education policy, teacher pay, etc., you definitely need to be following the work of our guest here, Dr. Terry Stoops. Terry, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And that's all the time we have for the program this week. Thank you for listening. On behalf of my co-host, Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Hope you'll join us again next week for more Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.